Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at cindysheehansoapbox.com or cprmetro.org. Our topic today is mass incarceration in capitalist America, and our guest is Eugene Puryear. Eugene is a Washington, D.C. based activist. In nearly a decade of social justice activism, he has been involved in the anti-imperialist movement, helping to organize most of the largest U.S. demonstrations against the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Eugene has served as a key organizer around police brutality, prisoners' rights, and abuses in the U.S. criminal justice system. He was a 2008 vice presidential candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and serves on the editorial board of Liberation Newspaper. His writings can be found at liberationnews.org. Eugene Puryear, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me on, Cindy.
It's great to talk to you, Eugene. And I know we met in Washington, D.C., or Washed Up D.C., as I like to call it, several years ago. So it's great to see your activism and your analysis evolve the way it has been evolving, you know, and as well as mine has, and I hope that we all mature in our analysis. So it's wonderful to talk to you, Eugene.
No, for sure, and certainly it's a long-distance struggle we're in, so it's good to be on with you, you know, still here, still standing on both ends of the phone here.
And you wrote a book called Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America. Shackled and chained, did you realize how hard that was to say?
Yeah. I did realize how hard it was to say, but, you know, I felt if I gave people a little verbal challenge to start things off, maybe they'd think, you know, there's something inside worth deciphering as well.
Okay, I want you to say it three times really fast.
Shackled and chained, mass incarceration in capitalist America. Shackled and chained, mass incarceration in capitalist America. Shackled and chained, mass incarceration in capitalist America.
No, I just wanted you to say the shackled and chained part. Really.
Ah.
Anyway, it's a very serious subject. And as you know, I'm running for governor of California. And Jerry Brown, the current governor, is super, super vulnerable on this issue. Before we get into the broad aspect of your book about mass incarceration in capitalist America. Mm-hmm. And I think the capitalist part is very important to it. Can you give us just a rundown of the situation in California as you see it?
Of course. Well, you know, the situation in California is really one of the most dire. I mean, as we saw, of course, recently there is the second prison hunger strike from a number of individuals who are locked behind bars, really drawing attention to the terrible conditions. California is sort of the state that has the terrible distinction of having the Supreme Court of the United States bring down this decision saying that the prisons were so overcrowded that it was violating people's constitutional rights because of the terrible situations. And just to show how bad it was, even if following the Supreme Court decree, they said that California would be in compliance just by being 130% or so over capacity, which is, you know, unbelievable. California is also one of the states that has really pioneered the solitary confinement cells. In the Council of Europe in 2011 said that in solitary confinement, anything over 15 days should be considered dangerous. In Pelican Bay, there's over 500 people who've been in there for 10 years. And then, of course, whether it's three strikes laws, any number of things, California is really indicative of how terrible and injurious and immoral the mass incarceration phenomenon in America really is.
And then, of course, Jerry Brown has been ordered to, you know, reduce the population by the Department of Justice, and instead of releasing nonviolent offenders or those who, and 44, studies have shown that 44% of the people in California prisons have zero to a very low chance of recidivism.
And instead of releasing these people, Jerry Brown is using the surplus that was the state budget surplus now that we have that was gleaned off of the backs of the poor and working class here in California anyway. He's using that to put into the private prisons to actually, in essence, rent beds from them, from GeoCorp and Corrections Corporation of America, which is something that you also talk about in your book.
It is. And it's very insidious, really, to look at and see what's happening. Private prisons are growing, you know, massively in the United States. In so many other states, we're seeing sort of similar things where CCA and GEO Group are starting to be outsourced to. And it's sort of another way that mass incarceration is really trying to mutate itself a little bit, really. You know, an 80% jump between 2010 and 1999 in the number of people who are held in private prisons. And I think what we see in California is what we're seeing elsewhere is, you know, these politicians, and it's worth mentioning, I think, that Jerry Brown is a Democrat, and a lot of mass incarceration policies were things that were advocated in the 70s and the 80s, really principally by Democrats, at least as much, if not more, than Republicans. But what we're seeing Jerry Brown doing is really starting to capitulate to the forces who really believe in mass incarceration, and while on the one hand trying to comply with the court order, on the other hand not really trying to change anything and trying to use the private prison industry and what potentially, if we look at what Alec is trying to do, a private parole industry to send people into this profiteering corporate world and not changing the basics of mass incarceration while still trying to stick to the letter of these court decisions that ultimately are aimed at, to a certain degree, a small degree, alleviating the conditions inside prison. So it's a real insidious way to not even really pass the buck, wouldn't even be correct, but to really just sort of transform mass incarceration. And whether the overall numbers get a little lower or whatever, I think the one thing we'll see is that this is more of a transformation than any sort of, you know, real change in what's going on in California, a state where it's desperately, desperately needed.
Well, one thing that I've noticed, and you know, I told you while we were chatting before the interview that I was watching some interviews that you've already done for your book, Shackled and Chained, and that, you know, some of the comments on the YouTubes or whatever are, you know, very, you know, they're very callous, and I think they do reflect this capitalist incarceration industry we have here in the United States. But it's a hard issue to address with the working class because, you know, I don't care if the working class are Democrats or Republicans or whatever or nothing. It's a hard issue to address because there's little compassion for the men and women in prison because there's this propaganda or this myth that they're paying some kind of debt to society and that we don't have to, like, throw resources into the prison industrial complex when, in fact, California spends $60,000 per prisoner per year. But where is the rehabilitation? Where are the services for the prisoners? You know, you point out that some people that spend as little as $2 per day for food for the prisoners. So how do we address, the way I try to reach out to the working class is to say, you know, we're spending $60,000 per prisoner per year in California, but less than $9,000 per student per year that goes through K through 12. What if we had a readjustment of priorities about this? But how do we address people in our own class about this situation?
For sure. Well, you know, that's a great point, and I think that, you know, you really sort of hit the nail on the head and alluded to so much of it. I mean, when we look at the idea of mass incarceration and the penal system, it's so heavily based on, you know, what was happening when it started to arise, so heavily based on this idea of a culture of poverty, that there's some sort of defect or problem with people who are in prison and it needs to be corrected and thus they should go to these correctional facilities. And there's less and less attention, maybe a little more being brought back on it now, but certainly over the past 20 years, on the issue of the devastation, the economic and social devastation in these communities, working class, oppressed communities, which of course now has been compounded by mass incarceration. But if we're not talking about how to rebuild communities so when people do come home and as children do grow up that we have good, solid education that's not just rote learning but's really teaching people critical thinking, if we have social services that are allowing people not just to access different social services but helping us to connect to each other and different things that arise organically in communities be supported to help create a fabric amongst ourselves that really lends itself towards self-sustaining communities based on a decent standard standard of living for the people in this country, the working class people in this country. And I think that you're so right. It's so hard to talk to because on almost every major talk to working class people, because on almost every major point, we see so much demonization, we see so much, you know, propagandizing that you almost have to really reframe every bit of the debate. I mean, you had that great stat of the recidivism in California, and we can see these stats that exist about nonviolent drug offenders all across the country. I mean, what we even call crime is a huge issue.
So when I have gone to jail for my, my protesting,
mm-hmm.
I am in the cell with a lot of people who do just like petty acts of financial crimes. I remember being in jail one time with a young lady who was trying to work her way through school, and for 4 years she was working full time to put her sister through school, and now her sister was finished, so she was trying to pay her fees to go to school. This was in New York City once, by the way. And she, like, borrowed some money from her employer to pay her school fee, or she would have been kicked out of school. Now, I'm not saying that's right. You know, I'm not saying that she chose the right thing. But this brings in the capitalist America, incarceration in capitalist America. And I think in your last answer, you touched on a little bit saying, you know, that people are in prison for petty crimes, but the Wall Street robber barons get off scot-free. So this might be a good time to talk about, you know, how these, in the same cell was some women from Guatemala who were put in prison for selling bootleg CDs. They didn't speak Spanish. Their children were taken away from them. They didn't know where their children, I mean, they didn't speak English. They didn't know where their children were. So talk more about the how capitalism drives the mass incarceration system.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and those stories are just so indicative of what, you know, we hear so often when we study these issues. I think that capitalism, I mean, there's sort of two pieces to it. The one is sort of the contemporary piece, and then B, the historical piece for the past 30 years, and to start from the last first. You know, I think what took place in the 1970s, where you had a major economic crisis in the United States, which really created or took the bottom out of the so-called post-war social contract, where people were expecting a rising standard of living, and then because of the civil rights movement, you know, many black people were expecting to be integrated into this rising standard of living, and that didn't happen at all, and sort of the reverse happened, and neoliberalism came in, and the idea became, well, instead of, you know, giving people jobs, having social services, doing all these different things. Instead, we're just going to cut all that and get rid of that. And especially when it came to black and Latino communities, black communities in particular in America, it created really sort of a surplus population problem. You've got millions of people who are unemployed. There's no expectation from the point of view of the politicians and the people who run the politicians, the millionaires, the billionaires, the bosses, the people who own the corporations and run Wall Street, of trying to set up any sort of program that would employ people. And so you've got all these people on hand, and what are you going to do with them? And then ultimately you see, even before the rise of the war on drugs, when Reagan comes in and this idea that the most important thing from the point of view of criminal justice is more prisons, and then of course the war on drugs adding fuel to the fire, and things that people like Joe Biden had been pushing, like mandatory minimums and all of those things coming in. And so really for the capitalist social system in America, mass incarceration started as an issue of social control, as a way to deal with the fallout of the fact that they were destroying working class and oppressed communities in this country in order to benefit the profit making of the big business, and that they had no desire to really, you know, soften that blow or soften that impact in the areas where there was that, the areas that were the hardest hit, except for mass incarceration, militarized policing. And then as we've gone forward, and as the stories you just told show, you know, so often people, it's like you're playing with a loaded deck here. People are just put in this situation where, you know, you can't find jobs, or there's not enough money being paid by the jobs. There's no health care. There's no benefits. A lot of times the whole neighborhood you live in is completely, you know, run down and torn down. Education is bad. And so, you know, then people look at their options and they make certain decisions. And I think that ultimately we demonize people for that, and people say, oh, well, they shouldn't have done that. But when you're put in these positions where you're balancing, you know, the rent against helping someone pay tuition or buying your kids clothes or food or all these different things that happen, it really creates a situation where things like dealing drugs or robberies or things like that take on sort of a new logic that, to, you know, many people might say, oh, that's the wrong thing to do. But when you're not in that situation, it's easy to say. And I think, so there's sort of those two pieces, A, mass incarceration as a way for capitalism to deal with the social fallout of their own exploitation of the mass of working people in America, and two, the fact that it just, capitalism as a system, particularly right now, it just sets people up for really what are almost impossible situations, where oftentimes what is deemed criminal activity can seem like the most logical of choices. And so instead of dealing it with like these people are crazy or something like that, I think going back to what we were talking about previously, we have to deal with the root cause of a social system, of a type of way the economy and the society runs, that only really cares about profit, doesn't care at all about people, and will run over anybody who wants to try to stand up and say that's wrong. We have to deal with that root problem that puts people in these situations and creates these sorts of problems.
So it seems to me that racism is an important part in institutionalized in capitalism.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's huge. It goes way back, really, if we look at the racist system in America and its history in the slave system, the rise of slavery out of indentured servitude, and the rise of codes governing different rules and laws for blacks and whites and different imperatives and things of that nature, which was really used by the early colonial ruling classes to divide people. And I think since then we've seen racism just become a more and more, you know, insidious and deeply ingrained form of division that, you know, perhaps sometimes seems to operate on its own, but really is something that has been sanctioned for hundreds of years by the highest levels of society and has become deeply ingrained in the pores. And I think with mass incarceration, it's the exact same thing. When we look at who is victimized primarily, I mean, you know, we look at the studies all the time that show that blacks and whites don't really use drugs at any different sort of rate, but yet and still blacks are incarcerated for drug crimes at much higher rates. And so these sorts of biases and things that exist from the point of view of racism are deeply ingrained in the society, and really mass incarceration is one of the chief ways that we can still see racism is manifested in a major way inside of our society and is still a major part of capitalist America.
And this was what was discouraging to me when I was reading the comments on the interview that you did with Abby Martin from Breaking the Set on RT. And you were giving statistics, and you were talking about inherently racist capitalist system, the prison industrial complex, and this mass incarceration, of course, is just another manifestation of empire. But when you were talking about it and giving statistics and telling facts about this mass incarceration, some people accused you of race baiting.
And, you know, it's funny how that works, how if you bring up anything factually or not that talks about, it's sort of like a tyranny now around this whole idea of a post-racial America. If there's a black president, then all of a sudden, like, no one should ever say anything about racism. And if not, you just kind of inject it into the argument. And it shows sort of the power, I think, of racism, and Barbara Field speaks about this a little bit in her book Racecraft, that it almost, it's such an emotional thing, it almost transcends logic. And as soon as people hear, oh, well, he's trying to inject this in and just, you know, make people think that it's all about white people hating black people, when the general point I'm making is that this is reality. And I think that people need to be able to confront that reality. But, you know, 30 or so years after the Civil Rights Movement, I think a lot of times for many people with white privilege in America, it's hard to confront that reality because they have to confront themselves and their own biases.
And we've seen since the downturn of the economy and the massive amounts of money spent on the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, the lack of jobs and opportunities, the astronomical cost of healthcare and education, that it's really, and it always has been, but I think what might be frightening some people, at least the people I talk to, Eugene, is that they're seeing that it's not a racial problem, it's a class problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately that's what we have to really get down to. And I think, you know, because of the long, not long, but I guess maybe 25 or so year history we have of, you know, many good things happening. I don't want to just throw out postmodernism and say a negative thing, but, you know, a huge focus in academia and in progressive movements on issues of identity, which, you know, are important. Obviously, we need to celebrate the diversity of all of us, but ultimately, when we look at these problems, when we look at racism, like I mentioned, its roots in the colonial economy, when we look at unemployment, when we look at all of the sort of social ills that we're fighting and that many of us on the, you know, left side of the spectrum can agree on, we can see they have their roots in a class-based system, in capitalism, which is ultimately about one small class of people taking the profits from another class of people. And obviously, you can always find ways to, you know, bring in the nuance and the details and how exactly it works. But ultimately, capitalism is a class-based economic system. And the one thing, if there's one thing that unites the broad mass of people in this country, it's that they're exploited by the capitalist class, even if they don't know it. I mean, I said to someone the other day, you know, going to work in so many ways is almost like being robbed. You don't really have a choice, because if you don't work, you don't eat, unless they don't let you work. And if, you know, you get a chance to work, you got to work at the wages and the places and under the conditions that they give you. And if not, you know, there's going to be someone else who's down on their luck who they're going to bring in for you. So ultimately, you know, this capitalist system really unites all of us on that basis, on the basis of being exploited, on the fact that we have to work and labor for someone else to make sure that at the end of the day we can live, eat, breathe, all that kind of stuff, and, you know, have leisure time, of course, only on their on the way they explain it. So ultimately, we have to come to that realization. When we talk about mass incarceration in capitalist America, it's not just a trope. It's a realization of the fact that capitalism is a real class-based system, and that if we don't fight the ruling class as a unified force, we can't really fully deal with the root cause of all these problems.
Right, and capitalism creates so many prisons without bars, like you just talked about.
No, it's 100% true. I mean, I was in New York City the other day, and it's crazy now to see the NYPD has, like, these like, mobile watchtower things that they just set up in oppressed neighborhoods, and you really do feel like you're in an outdoor prison when you're just walking around, and every, you know, 4 or 5 blocks, there's these watchtowers just rising up in the street where people are being observed. We see there's the NSA, the fact that, you know, people are trapped in this terrible form of housing, people are homeless. I mean, really, we are, there's so many different sort of walls and bars that are around us, even when we're not locked up.
Have books like yours and information sharing and presenting the issues in the way you do. It's, you know, one of the most important ways to present the issue, the systemic disease in this country. And, you know, you and I support, you know, socialist revolution. And what are some solutions to this problem that you see that might be possible before that? I'm not an incrementalist know, I don't believe that the solution lies within capitalism, but really, what can we do about it, Eugene?
Well, I think there's a few things we can do. I think one thing we're starting to see momentum on is mandatory minimums. We saw Attorney General Holder say that they want to attack mandatory minimums. I think we should not only, you know, support any effort to reduce mandatory minimums, which is one of the key drivers of mass incarceration, but also demand that it be made retroactive. So people who have been thrown in jail for some, you know, minor amount of marijuana or something, who now with the change in mandatory minimums wouldn't go to jail, that they can get out. I mean, I think things like that, fighting the war against the war on drugs are one. I think two, really supporting the efforts of community-based peacemaking organizations. It's sort of a secret, unfortunately, in the mass media that there really are a lot of people who come out of prison, who form organizations or work individually to try to intervene with, you know, gangs and individuals and young people who are getting caught up in the same thing that sent them to jail, and really try to build with them. And oftentimes these people get vilified by the police because they recognize why young people have an adversarial attitude towards the state, and they don't necessarily discourage that. So I really think we need to not just be promoting this idea of, you know, policing, but the idea of communities policing and healing, really healing is a big word to put on there, amongst themselves. So supporting those sort of street peace organizations, I think, is a second big thing we can do. So fighting the war on drugs, supporting that, the sort of peace intervention. And three, I think ultimately, you know, when we're talking about solutions as well, we have to combat these fake solutions that are happening. I mean, for example, you see ALEC now, which put in all these laws to really push forward mass incarceration, starting to put in all these laws that are meant with really moving mass incarceration to a privatized area. We need to continue to fight that. But I definitely think fighting the war on drugs will reduce the number of people in prison. Helping community organizations and those returning from prison intervene in their own communities will help these communities start to heal and start to organize to fight back, because ultimately that's one thing that's necessary too. And really pushing on those things, I think, can be big. And then continuing to fight against capitalism in a general sense, because ultimately if we don't have a long-range vision, then our short-term efforts will really come to naught.
Thank you. And this might be something a little off the wall. I don't think I've seen you address this in the interviews that I've seen you do, but there's this Netflix series called Orange is the New Black.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've watched it, but it's a very sensational, it's based loosely on the book by Piper Kerman, who was white middle class woman who went to federal prison for crimes, you know, like money carrying for drug lords or something like that. And I read the book, and she actually does talk about these issues of, you know, I mean, she's very compassionate about the women and the reasons that they're in prison, and she came to the conclusion that her participating in carrying money for these drug lords was helping bring these other women to prison. And she does talk about mandatory minimums and things like that. Have you read that? Do you know about that story? Do you have any comments about it?
I don't know the story particularly. I definitely know the show. I haven't gotten a chance to check it out yet. But I do think in general, from the people who have seen the show and are talking about it and asking me about it, I think it's been good. I mean, I think ultimately stories like hers, you know, one, just being from the background that she comes from, it can reach a lot of people who, you know, right, are probably 100% about mass incarceration. But two, I think whether it's a fictionalization or a documentary or something like that, those sort of personalized stories, and oftentimes like fiction can do this a little better too, like TV and things like that, because people don't start injecting all these things, is humanize the thing to a bit. And I think that's kind of a big thing, because, I mean, and you sort of mentioned this from the start, that there's so much demonization and things of that nature, but it really is, or like, you know, locked up on MSNBC or something, which is in and of itself interesting, the so-called liberal TV network. But ultimately, you know, showing people that these are real people, that real things happen to, things that oftentimes a lot of us can imagine, like, oh, well, I could actually kind of imagine being in that situation. Maybe this isn't so bad. I think shows like that, whatever, you know, critiques people want to make, and documentaries, and just starting the discussion around humanizing people is, you know, it's a less tangible thing, but I think it's an important thing for us to do.
Well, what kind of cracks me up about reading her book, the show is just totally sensationalist. It's entertaining, but it's sensationalist. But about reading her book is how many times someone asked her, "What are you doing in here, Blondie?" You don't know, Eugene, how many times when I've been in prison, if I'm not in a cell that's exclusively all of my fellow anti-war activists, and we're in with people, it's usually people of color, they say that to me 100% of the time. People are so shocked that someone that looks like me is in jail.
Well, I think in a way, because of why you're usually there, it's sort of a powerful thing.
Doesn't that say a lot about our system?
Oh, I mean, it says so much about it. I mean, the assumptions that not only the system makes when they put people in jail, but just the assumptions that, you know, almost every day, I mean, people who even aren't even necessarily, you know, bigoted or whatever, just the everyday assumptions people make about who's in jail, why they're in jail, you know, what it means that they're in jail, does so much to really, you know, harm the efforts to move forward on this issue. It's a difficult one, but I think it's one that at the very least we're starting to see a few things break open on, so I'm not pessimistic as much as I'm recognizing the huge obstacles we have in front of us.
And just one final thing. Whenever I go to jail and I'm in with, you know, my sisters of color who are in there for whatever, we talked about petty financial crimes, drugs, prostitution, whatever it is, they always ask me, they say, "What are you doing in here, Blondie?" Mm. And then when I tell them, they always say, "But isn't that our right? Isn't protest our right?" And in Orange is the New Black, Piper Kerman is actually in federal prison with people from School of Americas and, you know, a nun who was arrested for protesting. So talk about this incarceration and political prisoners. One interview I saw, you had a poster of the Cuban Five. And, of course, we're very people on my show, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, know about the Cuban Five. So talk briefly about our system and political prisoners.
Of course. And at the end of the book, we have some profiles of political prisoners. You know, people say there's no political prisoners in America. There's hundreds. And I think that it's an important aspect to realize, because so much of the law and order demonization that's used to back up mass incarceration found its roots in the radical movements of the late 60s and the attempts to demonize those movements. And, you know, the vast majority of political prisoners are, you know, incarcerated for that reason. But as you mentioned, protest is consistently, you know, criminalized in America. School of the Americas Watch, the AKA School of the Assassins, sending people all over Latin America and now even the world, who then subsequently torture and massacre and murder people, and then people who just jump over the fence to go inside of there are slapped with these prison sentences and sent in there. Individuals who are working for peace are sent to prison for long periods of time simply for, you know, quote-unquote trespassing. I mean, it's not like they, you know, walked into School of Americas or one of these military bases and whipped out a submachine gun and started shooting people. I mean, they were just bearing witness, and yet they're treated as if they have done something that is akin to a violent crime against another human being, which speaks very heavily to the reality of this system, is that protest that challenges the system, that challenges the status quo, challenges capitalism ultimately, but even lower than that, militarism and anything in a direct way, is almost always criminalized. Because if you didn't criminalize people, if you didn't get 6 months to, say, I think 3 years is what they usually get. I think some people have been in for much longer for School of America's Watch. Everyone would do it. All 20,000 people who go there every time would go over there, and it would make that base completely ungovernable. So they use that criminalization to try to chill the mass movement of people who really do think what they do there is wrong. And I think we can say the same about the brave people who've been arrested at drone bases and fighting nuclear weapons over the years with plow shares and Catholic Worker and Pax Christi and groups like that, Fellowship of Reconciliation. And one thing I will say, too, just to finish, too, this is actually one of the strongest traditions of protest in America, though, is people bearing witness against this, you know, these terrible things and accepting this criminalization to show that there's a deep opposition in this country to this kind of injustice. And I think that's something that we should fight to free all political prisoners, but also celebrate their heroism and their courage for being willing to put their lives on the line, frankly, and you know, long periods of it to make these points and to raise these issues.
Well, Eugene Perrier, this has been a really wonderful interview, and it's been wonderful to speak to you. Can you tell our listeners how they can get more information about your book?
Definitely, and this has been great. Thank you so much. You can go to www.shackledandchained.com, which is the book website. You can order it on there. You can also find links to our Facebook page. We have a Shackled and Chained Facebook page, which you hopefully will go to and like. If you really want, you can follow me on Twitter at Eugene Perrier, but www.shackledandchained.com, that's the book website. That's how you can find out more and also get in touch with us. So I look forward to really being able to interact with people who listen to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox and as we move forward here.
Well, Eugene, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and talk to you soon, I hope.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Well, that's the Soapbox for today. I hope you check out Eugene's book, Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and he's the contact with Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank my guest, Eugene Perrier, and I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.